At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh. I'm Tony Bruschi. Let's head to the courtroom for our first segment.
Be seated.
Good morning. I want to remind everyone in the courtroom that the courtroom decorum must be maintained at all times. You're not allowed to react to any testimony, cheer, jeer, nor speak in the courtroom unless it's during a time I said, let's take a stretch break. You can speak at that time, but otherwise we need to maintain order. Anything before the jury comes?
The firm state, Your Honor.
Your Honor, a couple of sort of housekeeping matters. One is we expect to rest today. We've got three witnesses. I don't know how they could go all day, but direct ought to be relatively quick. We're going to rest today, I believe, and then the state is going to call several somewhere. We've been told up to four. Maybe it's five, maybe it's six, but whatever. I think there's a high likelihood that they will rest on their reply case by tomorrow afternoon, Wednesday morning?
Tomorrow afternoon, I believe we can get done and be on track to close and charge on Wednesday, Your Honor.
With this caveat, we believe it would be useful for the jury to visit Moselle, both the area in the area of the kennels and the house, just to get some understanding of spatial relationships. What we would ask is that you ask the jury if they want to do that. I mean, I know I wouldn't, man, if they don't want to do it, I don't want them to do it. If they want to do it, that'd be fine with me, and it needs to be done in an expeditious way. And obviously, Your Honor's dealt with this before. We're not going with them, but I don't know who does go with them. No one's obviously going to be able to answer questions. They can see it. And that's, I don't know whether that should take any more than Roselle's about 30 minutes from here? 40 minutes from here. So that's 40 there, 40 back. An hour on the scene, maybe 3 hours. And I just throw that into the mix, not wanting to get this case closed. But we believe they ought to be given the opportunity to ask to see it if they want to see it. And I don't know whether that's done by majority vote. I don't know how all that's done. But we're asking they be allowed to do that if they want to do it.
I don't know that I've heard of just asking the jury and having them take a vote on that. I am not, the state is not asking for there to be a jury view of the scene. And if anything, I think that that would require additional testimony because the scene is different than it existed on the night of June 7th, 2021. And a big factor, which I think is very relevant to some of the issues here, is that the trees that were planted that separate the kennels and the house are markedly taller and thicker than they were on June the 7th. The state is not asking that there be a jury view, and I don't think the defense is either, and I'm not aware of any procedure where we just kind of throw it into the jury's hands to take a vote. So we would object to that proposal.
And Your Honor, if Your Honor wanted to instruct them, they're only there to see the kennels. There's no issues that they should be viewing the house or because the scene is – that has – we concede that would that's changed, but the kennels – the spatial, how small the feed room is, the spatial between where, and they've seen the pictures, where the feed room is compared to where Maggie's body was, compared to where the quail pens are, where the doghouse is. I mean, you just can't really appreciate the spatial issues without actually seeing them. And if you want to limit it to just the kennels and them not being allowed to in any way deal with the relationship between the house and the we actually do have some photos from that night and the next day. I mean, I think you can put restrictions on it that would assist the jury if they want it. I don't know whether they vote or whether you ask the forelady. Or, I mean, I've seen it done where the judge asks the jury, do you want to go to the scene? Now, I can't, it's been a while. I can't remember whether it was a vote, but he did ask the jury. It was sometime in the dark ages of the early 80s.
And we certainly don't object to putting any sort of vote to the jury at this point in time. I've never heard of any such a thing. Generally, jury views are at the request of a party. And
I'm requesting.
Well, again, I don't know that it's necessary in this particular instance or that it would be a particular help rate to the jury. And if anything, it may confuse the issues again because the property has changed since the night of June 7th, 2021.
All right. Anything else?
No, sir.
Okay. Upon request of either side, the court will allow a jury view. I will not ask the jury to decide whether or not they want to view. I think that would invite premature deliberations in the case, or just the mere fact that they would have to discuss that issue, I think, would invite premature discussions of relevant facts, what might be relevant facts. If either side wants a jury view, the court will arrange a jury view. And the court will go, the lawyers may go if you want to go. Of course, there are so many lawyers, that's a mammoth team in of itself. And I can advise the jury as part of the going to the scene that the certain things may not be the same as they were 2 years ago, whenever the period of time was. So if the defense wants a jury view, then the court will arrange a jury view.
Your Honor, thank you. And I just bring this to the court's attention. There were literally dozens of people at Moselle last weekend trespassing to get selfies in front of the feed room. I mean, most distasteful kinds of things I've ever seen. So perhaps before they head out there, some of the security could be in place, and so they don't.
Law enforcement security scene, ensure no one is there.
Well, John Marvin, his brother, is maintaining that property. He had to call the sheriff's department to come remove him, and it seems they have they're sort of a carnival attitude about this case than what we have to deal with. So I don't want the jury influenced by, you know, crazy paparazzi. I don't think there's really any.
No one can be there. The scene will be secure. No one will be there during a jury view. Now, do you want a jury view? Does the defense want a jury view?
I do. I just want to ensure that the security is not caught unawares about what a circus is going to be outside the property. And they've got the authority to close off the road. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not telling them how to do their job, but I am suggesting these are things that we became aware of over the weekend.
All right. We'll arrange for a jury view with with law enforcement. All right. Anything else?
No, Your Honor.
Hey, you may bring the jury. All right. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. Welcome back once again. Day number 25. The defense's case. You may proceed.
Court, Your Honor. The defense would call Dr. Jonathan Eisenstadt to the stand, please. And Your Honor, while he's coming around, Dr. Eisenstadt is a pathologist. We're going to be, first of all, showing some pretty graphic photos on the computer and the Elmo. And secondly, we're going to be talking about some pretty graphic details. So we will be offering exhibits. We should, we don't have to do it out of the gate, but certainly 10 minutes into his testimony, we're going to be showing some pictures and discussing matters that are going to be pretty graphic. So a number of these exhibits, not all of them, but 90% of them, we're going to move to introduce under seal. Some of them are already introduced under seal. And we've warned the family that if it gets too graphic, they can leave. So if Your Honor sees some of the Murdaughs get up walking out, that would be because it's, again, extremely graphic. So,
Good morning. Raise your right hand. Do you affirm the testimony you're about to give the court in this trial shall be the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you. Take a seat in the witness stand. You can adjust the mic. Please state your name again for the record. Spell your last name.
Jonathan Eisenstadt, E-I-S-E-N-S-T-A-T.
Doctor, what do you do for a living?
I am a medical doctor who specializes in forensic pathology.
And where do you practice medicine?
In the state of Georgia.
Could you tell the jury, please, what forensic pathology is?
Sure. Forensic pathology is a subset of pathology which really deals with investigating the cause and the manner of someone's death.
Okay. And let's get a little bit of your history. You went to the same medical school as Dr. Reamer?
I did.
And then after, I think you went to the University of California, Davis undergraduate?
That's correct. I grew up in California.
Graduated from there in 93. You went to the Sacra School of Medicine, as did Dr. Reamer, and you graduated in 98?
Yes, sir.
And then you did a residency where?
Well, when I came out of medical school, I initially wanted to be a surgeon. So I started out in general surgery in Staten Island, New York, and quickly realized it was not the profession I wanted. Beautiful profession, but not for me. So I transferred into a pathology program. This is all up in New York, out in Long Island. And to become a forensic pathologist, you first have to do what's called anatomic pathology, which is hospital-based pathology. If you've ever had anything taken out of your body, surgery or blood or anything, that goes to the pathology department. We look at it, we diagnose it, we tell your doctor, and your doctor will tell you what the diagnosis is. After doing all of that training, I did a year of pediatric pathology at New York University to study diseases of childhood. After that, I did a year of forensic pathology fellowship in the Office of Chief Medical Examiner in New York City, and then stayed on one more year in New York City as a medical examiner or forensic pathologist while doing more training in forensic neuro and cardiac pathology.
And that would have been in 2000, well, that would have been through 2004.
Correct. My forensic pathology training started in 2004 to 2005, and then from 2005 to 2006, I did my forensic neuro and forensic cardiac training.
So would that have been with the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner of the City? Who would that have been with?
With the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner of New York City.
Okay, and how long did you do that?
Well, the forensic pathology was 1 year. The forensic neuro and cardiac was another year. So that's two total.
Okay. At some point, did you leave New York?
Yes, after I completed those forensic subspecialties, I was offered a job at the Georgia Bureau of Investigation in Atlanta. I accepted the job and moved to Atlanta in July of 2006.
Did the Georgia, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation have their own medical examiner?
Yes, so the state of Georgia, there are, Metro Atlanta has its own medical examiner offices. So there's Fulton County, Cobb, DeKalb, and Gwinnett. So four of the 159 counties in the state of Georgia has their own medical examiner.
Per county or total?
Per county. Okay. So one for each of those counties.
Okay.
And then the GBI, for short, covers the other 155 counties in the state. And when I first started there, there were, I believe, five or six offices. And then over time, it sort of shrunk down to three offices, and I was at the headquarters office in Atlanta.
So when you initially started with a medical examiner's office in Georgia, who did you start with?
So I was with the GBI as my full-time job.
Right.
But I did do some moonlighting pretty much at all, well, at the Fulton County office, the Cobb County office, and the DeKalb County office.
So those three counties are, they comprise the metropolitan area of what city?
Of Atlanta.
Okay. So, and is that a rather large metropolitan area?
Yes. That's why each one of those counties have their own freestanding medical examiner office.
And, but you did part-time work for all three?
Yes. And I actually still do now for Fulton County and then hopefully soon one of the other counties.
Okay. So, tell me about your work with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and how did that differ from what you were doing for these other counties?
So at the GBI, that was my full-time job.
What did you do? What was your job?
Oh, my job was as one of the workhorse pathologists doing, when I first started, I believe it was about 250 autopsies each year. And then as time went on, the caseloads increased. And so I would say I was doing anywhere between 250 to maybe 350 autopsies per year. I would be testifying in court. We had residents that would rotate. So the hospital pathology residents would rotate in our office. We would lecture. And then that went until 2014 when I was promoted to deputy chief medical examiner.
Okay. Now, the autopsies you were doing, and would you generate reports for each one of those?
Absolutely.
And were these, you indicated early in your career you were doing general pathology. That is, if you had a polyp taken out during your colonoscopy, you would be doing those.
Yes, that's a requirement to be able to take the forensic pathology fellowship and boards.
So at this stage in your career, when you're doing autopsies, typically, how did those folks expire?
So those are sudden, unexpected deaths, whether they are just, we don't know what happened. You know, a 45-year-old individual found dead in their residence. No one knows why they died. We would get those cases. But then, obviously, all of the traumatic and non-natural deaths would be investigated by the medical examiner. So anything from car accidents to gunshot wounds, stab wounds, fights and somebody died, things of that sort.
Okay. So you did autopsies on people who died of under traumatic circumstances?
Absolutely.
Including gunshots?
Yes.
And now you just indicated promoted to deputy chief medical examiner for the GBI. How did that change your duties?
So that added a little bit of administrative duties. Thus, I sort of dropped back a little bit in the number of cases. So I probably at that time I would be doing about 200 autopsies. That was just for 1 year until 2015. So maybe about 100 autopsies, but now I was overseeing other doctors, investigators. And then we have a unit at the GBI, which is called the Child Abuse Investigative Support Center. And so we would actually do, I oversaw it, but I wasn't the doctor in it. So I know that sounds a little weird, but the person who did most of the work in that was a doctor and an investigator. But as I moved up, you know, that sort of became under the umbrella of what I would oversee.
Were those child deaths or?
They were living consults and deaths. So district attorneys the Child Protective Services from around the state may come and ask, hey, is this an accidental injury? Could the child have fallen off a bike? Or is this abuse?
And did you review those cases?
A few of them. But really, the vast majority was done by one of the other doctors.
Were you still reviewing death cases?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So if somebody did an autopsy on somebody who died of trauma, would you review their findings and the evidence?
Well, I was doing plenty of autopsies still myself. And what we had started doing was we would do rounds on all of the bodies that were in the morgue in the morning, and so we would discuss them all. And then in the afternoon, we would revisit all of those in a meeting and discuss, hey, does this look, if we're focusing on gunshots, do you think this is a contact, a close range, a distant range? If we're not sure about the directionality, we would discuss that. That wasn't specifically me. That was all the doctors. But then when I became chief, all of that became the scheduling and the meetings would become my responsibility.
So, and did you, what, after you were the deputy, what happened?
So then in November of 2015, I became the chief medical examiner for the state.
For the state of Georgia?
Yes, sir.
And were you continuing to do autopsies?
I did because I wanted to, I didn't want to lose my skills. So I did continue doing autopsies. At that time, I dropped down to about 100 autopsies that I personally performed per year.
Right.
But I, you know, I was now involved in more policy writing, administrative duties, going down to the legislature and lecturing. You know, it was during the opioid epidemic. So there were a lot of things going on. But if there was a case that was very difficult, it's written in the policy of the GBI Medical Examiner's Office that the chief medical examiner was the final arbiter of those cases.
Okay. Now, you did that, you said, until January 22.
That's correct.
Which would have been last year.
Yes, sir.
What, now, have you been doing other things during that period of time in addition to being chief medical examiner?
Well, yes, I was doing some consulting work. I would do that at night and on the weekends, unless I, you know, was in deposition, then I'd take personal leave to go do that. But those were the two main things I was doing.
Did you form a private consulting firm in 2008?
I did. Not in 2008. I started my first consulting case was in 2008. It was a cardiac death in New York, and the ME's office in New York referred the attorney to me. But I don't believe I started my actual, business probably until about 2013 or 14.
Okay. I've misread this. So, tell us what that is called and what you do.
So that's called Eisenstadt Forensic Pathology. It's nothing fancy. And really what I do is, an attorney or a family may call me. Ask me to review a case or to perform a private autopsy. And if I have the time, I'll accept that. I'll look over the documents. I may do an autopsy if that's what the family's requested. And then if it's an autopsy, I'll tell the family what my findings were. And, you know, I recently had one where I referred the family, I told them to go to their cardiologist and get tested because I believe the person had a genetic disease that could be transmitted to their offspring. If it's just a record review, I'll review the records and I will tell the attorney what my opinions are. If my opinions support what they are hoping, then I may hear back from them. If my opinions don't, I probably don't ever hear back from them.
So, did you have permission from the GBI to do that?
I did. Every single, while I was at the GBI, every single consult case that I did, I got written approval by my superior, who was the deputy director of the agency.
Now, have you ever been qualified to testify as an expert in the area of forensic pathology, especially in gunshot wounds, in any state or federal courts?
Yes. So throughout the state of Georgia, obviously. As far as gunshot wounds in other states, I've been qualified as an expert in forensic pathology in a number of states.
How many states have you been qualified to testify in as forensic pathologist?
Probably in the area of 20, 25.
Okay. And you've been qualified in the state of Georgia by both state and federal courts to testify about gunshot wounds specifically?
Yes, sir.
And have you done autopsies on people who are the victims of a shotgun wound?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You have any idea on how many occasions you've done that?
Oh, I'm sure myself I've probably done 75 to 100 or something to that effect, and then been involved in many more.
Okay. Tell me what the National Association of Medical Examiners is.
So that's actually the primary national organization that every profession has their own national organization. And for us, for short, we call it NAME. NAME is really the main national organization for forensic pathologists. And they write position papers. We have annual meetings. There's a journal that comes through that organization. So it's the prime organization for forensic pathologists.
And do you enjoy any position with NAME?
I do.
What position or positions?
So I'm currently on the board of directors, and I sit on a few committees for NAME.
Okay. Now, you're licensed in the state of Georgia and New York?
Not New York anymore. When I left New York, I let my license lapse because I had a feeling I wasn't going back for quite a while. So currently I'm licensed in Georgia.
Are you board certified?
Yes, sir.
In forensic pathology?
Yes, sir.
And you've got a number of different articles and books, and you enjoy it. You teach at what schools?
So I was teaching at Augusta University, and that's the medical school that the Forensic Pathology Fellowship Training Program that I started at GBI. They were the sponsoring agency. But I've lectured at St. Louis University, at their master's course in death investigation. I've lectured all over the state of Georgia to law enforcement, to coroners.
How about Emory School of Medicine?
Yes. Well, at Emory, we had residents and fellows that would rotate through the medical examiner's office in Fulton County, as well as actually GBI. So we would teach them as well.
Okay. Your Honor, I'd move to have Dr. Eisenstadt qualified as an expert in the area of forensic pathology.
Says the state.
No objection, Your Honor.
He's so qualified.
Okay, let me talk to you. Let's get to this before they get to it. Are you being paid for your testimony? When I say paid for your testimony, are you being compensated to evaluate and testify?
Yes, I'm being compensated for my work.
And how much are you being paid?
Up until this point, I've been paid $3,000, and then I have another invoice that will come out after trial, which will probably be a number of thousands of dollars. I don't recall exactly.
Okay, you compensated by the hour or by the task or what?
No, by the hour. So when I review documents, I charge $600 an hour, and then for testimony, I charge per day, so 24 hours, and that's $5,500 per the day.
Okay. So, and is that unusual for doctors who testify, consultant testify, or is that the normal practice?
In my field of forensic pathology, I've been told I actually undercharge, but, there's some that charge less than me, and there's some that charge more than me.
Okay, I've got a number of topics I want to talk to you about today, but some testimony we had last week, I was going to say earlier this week, the weeks are beginning to mush together. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm an old guy. I forget things. I'm not sure what week it was. I apologize to the court and the state for my faulty memory.
May proceed.
So, sometime I believe last week we heard from the coroner of Colleton County. Did you watch that testimony or hear that testimony?
Not the coroner. I saw Dr. Reimers, the medical examiner's, but I did not see the coroner's.
Okay. Tell the jury, please, if a medical examiner or coroner comes on the scene of a suspected homicide, how would one, as a physician or medical examiner, how would one determine time of death? What procedure would you follow?
Oh, well, whether it be a homicide or not, any death scene, you want to try to get an idea. It's not an exact science, but you want to try to get an idea of what the body temperature is as compared to the ambient temperature.
Why?
Why? Because it can give you an idea of how long the body has been there. But there's a lot of factors. So the way that I always taught the investigators and coroners is if you walk into a room or you walk into an environment where there's a dead body, the first thing you do is put a thermometer down. Don't look at the thermostat on the wall. Don't look at the computer to see what it says. Put the thermostat down. Look in the area, start your investigation. Come back and look at the thermometer. That will be your ambient temperature.
Ambient temperature means what?
The temperature of the air in that area.
Okay.
And obviously you want to put it near where the body is. And then you take the thermometer and you do a rectal temperature. You put it in the rectum. But you leave it there and you start doing more of your scene investigation. Then you come back, you take it out, and then you have the closest to what we can get for a core body temperature. And you document those two. And then there's other things you look at. You look at blood settling, and you look at what's called rigidity, so stiffening of the muscles.
So why would you want a core temperature and an ambient temperature? What do you do with that?
Well, then you can the body will equilibrate. Will sort of even out with the ambient, so the outside temperature, between 1 to 1.5 degrees per hour. I will say it's not an exact science, because obviously if, you know, right now I'm sure my body temperature is a little higher because I'm on the stand. So I may not be 98.6 degrees right now, which is normal.
And if you were to die right now, it would not be appropriate. I'm not saying you should die right now, but so your temperature's up a little bit. Does that mean that you would start at a in your calculations at a higher temperature? What would you do?
Right. So that's the problem is that, let's say I'm 99.5 right now. So that's 1 degree higher. That already moved. We're starting to move that time frame out to it could have an hour faultiness to what you're going to do. So it's 100 degrees outside. My core body temperature is 99 degrees. So we have 1 degree difference. So you may say it's been about an hour, but, you know, unfortunately, television shows have made it seem like you can say it happened at this time. But in all honesty, you can't. But by far, the best methodology is to do a core body temperature.
And an ambient temperature.
And an ambient temperature, yes.
So tell me what you would learn by sticking your hand under the armpit of a deceased.
You wouldn't learn anything.
Really?
Well, you may learn that the arm can't come down because of rigidity, but as far as temperature, you have your own body temperature. You have, you're sticking it in an armpit, which is exposed to the ambient temperature. So that it's just not a valid method to try to make a determination of time of death.
Just a guess.
It's a guess, yes.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about, we're going to be dealing with some sealed material. Is everybody, is that TV off over there? What now? So, at our request, we're Mr. Murdaugh's lawyers, did you examine materials in this case?
Yes, sir, I did.
And let me first of all ask you if you examined these two documents. Your Honor, I'm showing the witness defendant's exhibit 177 and 178.
So 178, yes.
And tell us what that is.
That is the Medical University of South Carolina's autopsy file. So it's more than just the report. It's essentially the file for the medical examiner.
Okay. You examined this?
Yes, sir, I did.
Okay. Go ahead. What's the next one?
So 177 I did examine, and this is the MUSC file for Maggie.
This being 177?
Yes, sir.
So Maggie's 177 and Paul is 178?
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, we would offer these into evidence.
Your Honor, the state would object to these documents coming into evidence. Your Honor, Dr. Reamer testified to her reports. These are reports by Dr. Reamer. These are not reports generated by Dr. Eisenstadt. He has reviewed those reports. He can testify to the substance of those reports, but we would object to the reports themselves coming in as evidence.
Says the defense.
Your Honor, these are business records. They're kept in the ordinary course of business, according to Dr. Reamer. There's certainly nothing in here other than her findings, basically. So we'd object. I mean, these are what Dr. Reamer relied on, these documents. Certainly, under the business records exception, they would be admissible. I don't quite understand why the state would not want this jury to be able to see.
The state has objected, so the argument is not why they would not want them.
Business records exception, I'm sorry.
I haven't seen the exhibit. I can't rule without seeing what they are. Admitted over objection.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, I can come back to these a little bit. I'm primarily interested in her determinations and some sketches she did that are in that.
Okay.
So you examined her her report, correct?
Yes, sir.
And could I have the Elmo, please? Let's talk about Maggie to begin with, okay?
Okay.
And I'm going to put this on the Elmo. Can you tell me what this is, please?
That's a standard body diagram for a female.
And you reviewed this?
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's put this on the Elmo. And could I have the easel? What? Oh, you can?
Yes.
Okay, so this would be the body sketches. Maggie. Could I have the female?
What page is that?
I have no idea. What do you see on your screen?
I see the female body diagram from the autopsy of Maggie Murdoch.
Okay, so you know, if you could put it in that doorway up there,
sure. That
would allow the jury to see a little bit better. Push it back. There you go. So I must put this on it. Okay, so by way of, let's walk through the wounds on Maggie, okay?
Okay.
So look at the sketch in front of you and walk the jury through. If you need to come down here with a pointer, or can you do it from up there, whatever is more convenient for you.
There's a lot of writing, so it may be easier for me to point it out. I don't know if this is a touch screen or not.
Okay, so what I want you to do is step down here, please. And I'd like you to stand so that those jurors over there can see. So you probably need to stand over there.
Sure.
Okay, so how about walk them Yeah, okay. Walk them through the wounds on Maggie Boyer.
So I think the easiest would be to go from bottom up.
Okay.
So we have, these are all rifle wounds. They're all caused by a rifle. We have an entrance wound on the left thigh, and the entrance wound on the left thigh has on the diagram little dots, which is stippling, which makes it an intermediate range rifle wound.
What does that mean, intermediate range?
We're talking up to, you know, 1 to 3 feet. The end of the barrel to the actual skin where the bullet goes through.
Okay.
And I agree with what's Dr. Reamer put here. That's the medial left thigh. Now we flip the body over, and we have the, on the diagram, so this is now the left side, and we have the corresponding exit wound on the back of the left thigh. So I agree with the range of fire, the directionality, that it's an intermediate range rifle wound.
So you and Dr. Reamer agree?
Yes, we agree on this one.
Okay, next.
Moving up, we can go here to the torso. So we have another entrance rifle wound on the upper right torso. It, as per, I obviously can't see the inside in this, but as per the autopsy, it goes through a number of organs, goes across, and comes out the bottom left back of the torso. And I agree with that, with her finding on that as well.
Let me interrupt you one second.
Yes, sir.
Prior to your agreement or disagreement, did you look at the autopsy photos?
Oh, absolutely.
Did you look at her report and her notes?
Absolutely.
Anything else you looked at?
I looked at some scene photos, and I believe that was it.
Okay. But you're relying on her photos?
Yes. The most important for me is the autopsy report, the autopsy diagram, and the autopsy photos.
Okay. Okay. I'm sorry. Go to the next one.
Okay. So we now have, we've talked about one gunshot wound, a rifle wound, two rifle wounds. Now we have a rifle wound on the left wrist and forearm. We have an entrance on the back of the left wrist, which is the dorsal surface, and this is the ventral or volar surface. And the exit is on the volar left forearm. I agree with that as well. On the, oh, I'm sorry, I also looked at x-rays. That was
okay.
Part of the photos. On the x-ray, there are some little fragments of, you can tell it's a rifle round in the left wrist.
And it went through?
It went through, yes.
And entrance on which side?
On the back of the left wrist.
Okay, next.
So we've now talked about three of them. Now we have two. I'll start with the first one, which I agree with her findings, and then the second one is where I have, there's a discrepancy. So if we now look at rifle wound E, which is the one that's here on the back of the head,
yeah.
The directionality is correct, and I can explain why I believe the one on the left breast, the directionality was wrong. But we have a almost tangential, meaning that it doesn't go super deep into the brain, it comes here, but a rifle has a lot of kinetic energy and can, so it has a lot of force to it, and it can cause severe disruption. And it's coming along here, goes through the brain, and when this one goes through the brain, it causes an injury to the brain stem. That would make her die immediately. So this one came here, and then, which is the entrance on the back right of the head.
And that's labeled what?
That's labeled E.
Okay.
And then the, you can see on the x-ray, there's a little fragment or a few little fragments in the head. And so a rifle round will fragment, we call it a lead snowstorm. It sort of on x-ray looks like a snowstorm, a bunch of little white pieces. It breaks up. Pieces of projectile come through down into the back and continue down into the right chest. So this is, now remember we're talking about directionality. This is top, this is bottom. And so on the body, it's going downwards, but obviously we have a moving situation. So if she's like this, it may have been coming straight, but on the body, the directionality is downwards. And There are some up arrows here on the injuries to the upper back. I don't know why, because in her report, they go down. So that's all part of gunshot or rifle wound E. That's actually the lethal rifle wound, immediately lethal. And now I'll focus on A, C, and then the abrasion or the graze wound of the abdomen. And this is where I differ in opinion of directionality.
So you agree with her on everything except this one?
On Maggie, that's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So if we look at the autopsy photos, that's going to be extremely important.
We will in a minute.
Okay. So we do have a wound on the left breast. We do have a wound on the left chin. And we do have this abrasion under the left breast. And sometimes there are characteristics that we look for to try to give us directionality of these superficial gunshot or rifle wounds. And what you're looking for when it's a tangential wound is you're looking for skin tags. So
tell me what a skin tag is.
Sure. So if you think about it, if a bullet is coming and it hits the skin, and you can see how it's pushing the skin like this, so you're going to get these tears in the skin. And the tears in the skin are going to be in the direction that the bullet's coming. But if you let that go, between those two tears is a triangular piece of tissue left, right? So we have a tear over here, we have a tear over here, and then you let it go and you have a skin tag. You have a piece of tissue pointing in the direction that the bullet came from. And so when I look at the picture of the rifle wound to the back of the head, you can see all of those skin tags are pointing up this way, so the bullet came here. When I look at the left breast, and I look at the wound to the left side of the head, or excuse me, the left chin or jaw, I see skin tags pointing this way. So that would make this rifle wound come from here. It would be superficial, but remember we have all of that kinetic energy. So that's why we get the splitting of the skin, the fracture of the chin, then it comes down through the breast, and then it grazes the upper left chest. And it sort of makes sense when you think about it. If a person is leaning forward, and you've got one going down this way, you've got another one going essentially in the same exact direction. So there's the scientific aspect by looking at the actual outline or the actual look of the wound. And then you also have two wounds from a rifle that are right next to each other going in the same direction.
And you indicate that both of the directions of both of those, one that goes down this way to the and severs the brainstem, and then the other one that goes down and through her breast. Unless somebody were very, very tall, is there an explanation on how those wounds would have come about?
Yes. So, I mean, really, we know it's coming from the top of the head downwards, right? So unless someone is standing in an elevated position or someone is lying down on their stomach and then you have a sniper who's on the ground going this way, really, and we see this in people who are going to open the door because someone's knocking on the door and a gunshot comes through. If you're leaning, as I was saying earlier, if you're leaning forward, let's say the first shot here gives her significant pain. I agree with Dr. Reamer on that. And she's leaning over like this. Then if I have, I don't want to hit you, I'm sorry. I have a gunshot coming like this. Now I look at it, the body lying flat on the table. You can see how it goes straight down. So the explanation that I think is probably most feasible to is that she's leaning forward, most likely probably in pain from the abdominal wound.
And the second shot?
Same thing.
So she's leaning forward, one in the one back here, and where does the second shot come?
The second shot goes right next to the left ear, and on the autopsy photos, you can see a ring of a contusion or a bruise, and it looks very, very similar to her earring that was found there. And again, that's from the energy would push the earring up. It comes, the bullet comes down, goes through the breast, and out.
So that shot blew her earlobe off, or blew?
Pretty much, yes.
And the ring goes, they find at the scene, right?
Correct.
Okay, so let's walk through the photos, and if you'll stay right where you are, and then I'm going to maybe have you draw something up there. I haven't quite decided yet. Could I have Defendant's Exhibit 169, please? And I remind everyone we should be covered for this. Nope. I'm sorry. 159. Not your fault. Right. And again, I apologize for the graphic nature, but this is what you do every day, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So tell us what this depicts.
So this depicts Maggie's body on the autopsy table. And when we're doing our measurements on a body, that's how we're looking at the body, lying on her back or on the person's back on the autopsy table. And we're looking at the left side. Here is that wound with the left ear and the left chin. And here's her left breast. And then right above this wound here, we have that semicircle, which is consistent with the earring.
So this is the shot you would disagree with Dr. Reamer about?
This is the only shot I disagree with.
And her explanation of this was what? It was going up?
Yeah, she stated that it was going upwards.
It would have entered the breast and then gone up?
Right.
And the reason you disagree with that is?
Well, number one, there's skin tags. When we look closer at the breast and we look closer at the right, the left side of the chin, skin tags are pointing upwards, showing that that's where the bullet came from. And the other is, you know, there's also a part of our job where just sort of common sense, and it just seems very odd that when you have one going this way, you have to be in a very bizarre position to be able to get it to go up. But from the scientific standpoint, it's how the wound looks.
And you believe those wounds are caused by bullets fired in succession?
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay. Could we go to, Defendant's Exhibit 160. What does this depict?
So this is the left side of her jaw, and it's pulled forward, but you can see up here, I'll use my finger. You see the skin tag is pointing this way, right? The laceration is coming down here. And if I were to flip this back up, these skin tags point up as well.
Point out a skin tag again.
This is a great example of a skin tag that is like this.
Could you blow that up a little bit for me, please? Right around the, right below the here. Yeah, right in there, that's perfect. Okay, show me the skin tag.
Okay, well there's, if we were to, you see here that this is sort of in a triangular shape, and if I flipped it back up, it would fit right into here.
Right.
And so the skin tag is pointing upwards in the directionality of where the bullet comes. It'll be easier to see on the breast, actually.
Okay, so could we go to, doctor, this one?
Yes.
Okay, that would be Defendant's Exhibit 161. Okay, tell me, is that the area you want? Does that help?
Yes, but I think before we blow it up, I think what's important is for orientation purposes, you can see that her head is up here. So this would be up, this would be down.
Okay.
And now if we need to blow that up, you can see the skin tags are pointing up. The lacerations, the splitting in the skin, is pointing down. So that indicates an up to down directionality.
Okay. And could we see State's Exhibit 498? Tell me what this depicts.
This is a beautiful depiction. I don't mean to use that word. I'm sorry.
Beautiful is not.
I didn't mean that. That's from a forensic pathologist. It's a classic book example of the lacerations coming and pointing downwards. The skin tags are pointing upwards. So skin tag, skin tag, skin tag, all pointing up where the bullet's coming from. The lacerations are pointing down, which is the direction the bullet's going in.
Now, did you and Dr. Reamer agree or disagree on this?
We agreed on this.
Okay. Now, the other thing is, it appears her head was shaved. Why is that?
Right. So any gunshot wound to the head, if you're trying to make a determination of entrance or exit, or trying to get a better idea of what it looks like, you also want to look for if there's any gunshot residue. You shave that area. So most of the time is to look at the actual outline of it. Sometimes it's to preserve evidence for further testing.
Okay, could I have 168, please? And what is this an x-ray of?
So this is an x-ray of her head and neck. And it might be hard to see, but we have right here in the center, we have a fragment of possibly jacketing, but a fragment of a projectile right here in the midline with a few smaller pieces. We have nothing over on the left side where this injury is. So nothing went in here and stayed. All of the projectiles, and then we'll continue down to the chest. It's one rifle that went down, and then you'll see that lead snowstorm, which is consistent with it going back in to the back and down to the chest.
Okay, and could you go to 169, please?
So you can see here how it continues down into the right chest, and it sort of looks like a snowstorm. That's a rifle round.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead and take the stand, please. So your job is to look at the photos and determine whether or not the original pathologist was correct or incorrect. That's what we hired you to do, right?
Well, really, what you asked me to do was look at the autopsy report, look at the photos, and give my opinion on the gunshot wounds. That was it. I wasn't even asked to say, I wasn't even asked, is she right or wrong? You just asked me to look at them and give you my opinion.
And how many bullet holes do we have here? How many shots?
Well, we have five shots.
And of the five, you agree with her on four?
Yes, sir.
And disagree with her on one?
Correct.
Okay. So let's move on for just a moment, and let's look at, we'll go to Paul's autopsy report, and we'll go to his sketch. Let me get this material away. Okay, let me put this, jumble things up. So let's have him step down again with your pointer, please. It's right here. Your Honor, may he approach. Thank you. So how about detail what she indicates are the wounds to Paul? And we'll start, at the bottom and go up?
Sure.
Okay.
There's two shotgun wounds to Paul. One is on the chest, and one is on the head.
Okay, let's talk about the chest wound first.
Sure. So the chest wound is also an intermediate range so 1 to 3 feet. Shotgun wound that goes across the chest, does not enter into the chest cavity. It leaves near the armpit, and then the pellets themselves disperse, and some of them go through the arm. I agree with her on that, both on the range of fire and the directionality.
Okay. So the other shot resulted in his head exploding?
Correct.
Okay. Explain to the jury what she said, and then what you believe, and we'll talk about why the difference is in just a minute. Okay.
Sure. So in her autopsy report, she stated that she believed the entrance was coming from the left side, went up, and then it exited the top of the head. To me, this is a contact range gun, shotgun wound to the top of the head that caused extreme pressure buildup in the head from it being contact, leading to these types of fractures, and that the pellets, so the shotgun wound comes in, the wadding will start to open up. All of that pressure basically, for lack of a better term, will explode what's there because the pressure needs to get out somehow. And then the head would have been down like this, and the pellets lodged here and went into the left shoulder, and then you can see that the pellets are going down into the tissues of the left shoulder.
So you believe wound that resulted in his head exploding was where? Where would the shotgun have been?
Well, it would have been to the top back of his head.
And how far away from the head?
Oh, no, it would have been pressed against the head.
So it would be a contact wound to the back of the head?
Correct.
And that would result in, and we're going to talk about this in a little more detail in a minute, but if it was in the back of the head, tell me how we have a hole here and then a wound here. How does that work?
Well, you're shooting, it's different than shooting into a space where it can expand. It's not up against a firm surface. So shooting into the abdomen is different. The pressure will still go in if it's a contact to the abdomen, but the abdomen can stretch. The pressure and the gas can disperse because it's sort of an open space with skin that can stretch out and back. The skull really only has one hole at the very bottom. So if I were to take a shotgun and press it against this pile of paper here, and I were to shoot it, this paper would blow up because the pressure has nowhere to go, so it's got to blow everything up that's right there. If I were to take that shotgun and shoot it from here, the pressure is open. It's open to the free atmosphere, right? So it's going to come out of the barrel, and it's going to spread out. It'll go a little distance, and that's why we get soot in close-range shotgun wounds. It'll go a little distance, but then it'll disperse. So if I were here and I were to shoot down at this paper, the paper is going to get a whole bunch of holes in it, but it's not going to completely explode.
And this is birdshot, correct?
In the head, it's birdshot.
In the chest, it was?
It appears that it was buckshot.
Okay. Now, so her opinion was, and tell me the path.
So unfortunately, the top of the head wasn't shaved, so I can't tell you the exact entrance, but it absolutely is a contact range shotgun wound to the head. And from the way it was described by Dr. Reamer, what she described as the exit wound was that it was near the top of the head and a little bit back on the right. So probably right about here.
Okay. Now, let me talk to you a bit, if you take the witness stand again, please. Defense Exhibit 116. Okay, so, yeah, if you can blow that up a little bit. This is in evidence. Where did this exhibit come from? Is there a book?
Yes, this is from the main textbook on gunshot wounds by Vincent DeMeo.
And it has been described as the Bible for gunshot wounds. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, here we go. And that's, I think we asked Dr. Reamer about this book, and she agreed, right?
Yes, sir.
And this sketch, or this these pictures, are from that book?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So this depicts a shotgun shell being fired, correct?
Yes, sir.
And tell the jury, please, this is the initial firing, correct?
The very top image, correct.
And what is that coming out?
What's coming out are actually flames and gas. So sometimes you'll see a little bit of burning because the gunpowder is ignited, so you have a little bit of flame and then gas.
Now, if they had shaved Paul's head, which they did not, correct?
Correct.
Would they have seen some evidence of that gas and flame coming out?
I would say most likely yes. You don't always see it. But yeah, most likely there would be some soot or what we call searing burning.
Okay. The next one down, B, what is that showing us?
So now what we're seeing is at the front, you can see all the pellets that are still sort of in a cylindrical form because the wadding itself has not completely opened up yet. So, you know, the pellets are all, you have a plastic tube in essence. And then the pellets are all at the top, and then there's a piece of wadding, so like a plastic disc or something, and then underneath it, you have the gunpowder. The gunpowder gets ignited, the heat builds up the pressure, it pushes out the plastic tube through the barrel of the weapon, and that's when that first image, you see that. The second image, you see that we still have all of the shot, or the pellets are still within the plastic tube. And so that's going to go for a little distance. Behind it, we see the cloud of gas. We see the pressure from the cloud of gas. And this is still very early on in the shot.
Okay. And what's the next C? What does that depict?
Right. So now we're a little bit further out, a little bit later after the weapon's been fired. We still see that the pellets are in sort of a cylindrical form, and you can see that the cloud of gas is getting bigger, right? The reason the cloud of gas is getting bigger here is because it's going to go where? Via the path of least resistance. So it's going out into the atmosphere. This is not pressed against anything. This is just if I were shooting in the air and the gas is coming out.
And the last one, D?
A little further on, you can now see the pellets are just starting to separate, and we see this big cloud of gas. So the pressure is dispersing outwards into the atmosphere.
And if we had another shot 3 feet down or 4 feet down, what would be happening with those pellets?
So now you're starting to get individual pellets that the pellets would be opening up. So they wouldn't still be in that cylinder if we're talking 3-4 feet or further. So on the skin, we would start seeing a little outline of individual holes from individual pellets. It's not like they all have separated yet, but we would see some.
10 feet, would they be separated?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And so you'd see a pattern of shot?
Correct.
Individual pellets?
Correct.
Okay. So let's follow this back. Let's go with her scenario first.
Okay.
And the testimony, I think, has been 3 feet. The muzzle of the shotgun was 3 feet from, and let me maybe put one of these in. Okay, let me have State's Exhibit 478, please. Okay. Now, the wound in the center of his chest, you and she agree on directionality. It came out under his arm. Pellets penetrated his arm and then went on, I think we've heard, out the back window.
Right. So directionality and range of fire, I agree with her on that one.
Okay. So when you look at the wound in his shoulder and his neck and, of course, his head, tell us where Dr. Reamer got it wrong.
Well, I think she has it reversed. And the reason being is now that you've seen where all the pressure would go, if the entrance wound is here on the left shoulder, and we're saying that we're at least 3 to 4 feet away from there because we have no soot, we have no stippling on the skin, then by the time it gets to the left side of the chin or over here at the angle of the mandible, the jaw, we've lost a lot of energy. And so, yes, you can get some pellets still going up into the head, but you're not going to have the top of the head completely blown off. And if you look at the photograph here, you can see, you know, for all of us, it curves over and goes around because the top of our skull's there. If you look here, it goes flat. He's missing the top of his skull. That would not have happened from a 3 to 4 foot, 3 feet or further shotgun wound coming in on the left side.
And the wound on his shoulder, let's look at that real quick. Shoulder, please. That's a pretty big wound, is it not?
It is, and there's pellets that are going down into the tissue.
And what is the evidence of that?
Well, there's photographs that are taken looking down into the wound, and you can see pellets there, and there are x-rays that are taken that you can see there's pellets down into the left shoulder.
Okay, if you go to Defendant's Exhibit 162. Okay, step down here, please.
Yes, sir. May I?
Your Honor, may you step down?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. You stand over there with the pointer. Show the jury, please, the individual pellets.
Oh, well, this is probably the easiest one to see. Round and silver. I'm going to have to come around for a moment. I'm sorry. There's one here. There's one here. It's not projecting well, but I know that I saw a few down here. But then on x-ray, it'll become more apparent.
Okay. Well, let me do this. Let's go ahead and put the x-ray up while we're talking about this, which would be... Which one of these you want to start on?
We can do this okay. Thing since we're talking about.
Hold on 1 second. Any objections? Your Honor, I would offer into evidence Defense Exhibit 112 and ask it be put under seal.
No objection.
I submit it.
All right. Tell us what exhibit you got. Do you have that? 112? 112. Shocking, Ron, we have some technical issues here. This is, I don't know what happened to big poster boards. I just... Got it? No? Yes?
No, this is 112. I mean, it's going to take some time. Let's just put it on the Elmo and go from there. We're interested in this area. And I'm going to have one more. Okay, tell the jury, please, what we're looking at here.
Sure. So any case that comes to a medical examiner's office that has any type of penetrating injury, the medical examiner will do x-rays to see if there's anything left in the body and then also for safety reasons. But what we're looking at here is this is the spine. These are the ribs. So we're looking at the chest, the left shoulder, because we're coming out here to the left arm, and all of these dots are the pellets from the shotgun wound. And what we can see here is that these pellets are coming down all the way. So this is the first rib right here. First rib is about right here. So we have pellets all the way down to this level.
Is that consistent or inconsistent with a shot being fired from his left, apparently going upward to
right.
the brain?
That wouldn't be consistent. And the reason being is then it would have to, the pellets would have to go up, curve, and come down, while the rest of them are continuing this way.
Okay. So could I have this one next?
Sure.
Okay. Defense Exhibit 111. I can do Elmo.
I can. You got it. Okay, good.
Okay, this should be up on the screen now. Can you, we're talking about the lower right hand, I mean, our,
the left side of the body.
Left side of
the
body.
R stands for right, so the x-ray is being taken like this, right side, and this is the left side.
Okay, so could you blow up the lower R right corner, please? There you go. Now, what does this depict?
So this is showing here on the left side of the jaw, and we see all of these pellets that are here. So the jaw is right here, and you can see these pellets are in the left side of the jaw, in the neck, and they're going down into the upper left chest.
So, and you believe that the directionality on these is down?
Well, from the totality of the evidence, I believe, yes, they're downwards.
Okay. And,
But this x-ray has other findings, I think, that are important for that opinion.
Okay.
And, I mean, you can see the severity of the fractures of the skull. The skull should... Actually, I think it was better if we were back. The severity, the skull should obviously come all the way around, right? Mm-hmm. There's no skull here. That's probably the area where the shotgun was pressed against the head. And we've got all of these fractures. In medical terms, we call it multiple comminuted fractures. This is, I mean, textbook for a contact range shotgun wound to the head, to the top of the head, not down.
And, okay, so in your opinion, if it had happened the way Dr. Reamer said, you would not have the directionality of those pellets in the shoulder down,
correct?
And you would not have that kind of devastation to the skull. It wouldn't be enough energy.
That's correct. You may have some what we call linear fractures, so little lines of fractures, but you wouldn't have the top of the skull completely gone.
So explain to me, not being a hunter, how does the gas, you got gas coming first, pellets coming second, right?
Yes, sir.
So how do you get the gas going in and the pellets continuing on?
Well, the pellets are projected by the gas causing pressure to push out the shot and then the pellets within it. So You know, think about a rocket that's going up into space, right? So you see all of the cloud underneath the rocket, and the rocket will continue going up, but the cloud goes out because that's the area of least resistance. But the rocket will still continue. So that's pretty much the same mechanism. The shot cup is going to be pushed out. The energy from all of that gas needs to go somewhere. And when it's being pressed up against a firm surface like a skull, that pressure is going to build up. It's going to go through the hole that's caused by the entrance wound, and it's got nowhere else to go. So it is, and of course this is all happening in milliseconds, but all of that gas is expanding the inside of the skull, and the least resistance is right here at that opening now. So it's going to cause that area to basically pop out.
And some of the pellets would go through, most of the pellets would go through?
Oh, the pellets will continue through. There may be, the brain is not here, right? And so there's probably pellets within the brain, but we don't have an x-ray of the brain.
They didn't x-ray the brain.
Correct.
So, and the skull, I mean, the brain would leave the cavity? Or in this case, did it leave the cavity?
Yes, it did.
And under what kind of force?
I can't give you an exact, number. The forces are usually in what are called newtons, but it's the buildup of that pressure in the skull. It's even in that textbook. Brains being eviscerated in shotgun cases are from contact wounds.
So if you're the person holding the gun to the skull, does any of that energy go up the barrel of the gun?
Well, yes. Once that, like I said, it builds up in the head and then it comes back up. So that's what causes the brain to be pushed out. There's going to be pellets that will come out. There'll be other bodily fluids that will come out and will go up along. It'll basically be what we call back spatter or back motion.
But in a violent way.
Yes.
And the person holding that gun, would they be subject to being covered in that material?
Yes, they would.
In a very forceful way?
Yes.
Okay, so let me show you a couple other pictures. That's this photo, right?
That's that one.
Yeah, okay. Would you put Defense Exhibit 113, please? I believe this is an evidence. Okay. Tell us what that depicts.
So now we've moved over to the side, to the left, more of the left shoulder, and showing some of the left arm. And again, you see how the pellets are sort of dispersed and they're coming down. This is your shoulder blade, your scapula. And so it's even down to the level of the collarbone here and the shoulder blade.
Is that consistent with a shot coming up and across the shoulder and into the neck, or is it consistent with something coming down?
Well, again, with the totality of everything, this is absolutely going down.
Okay. Now, let me see. State's Exhibit 487. I'm sorry. Tell us what we learned from this.
Well, for lack of a better term, we have no brain or top of skull. It's completely gone with multiple fractures.
And was his hair shaved?
No, sir, it was not.
Would that have been the normal practice, the prudent practice, the required practice?
Yes, I would have liked to have seen it shaved to help determine an entrance versus an exit.
Okay. But with this autopsy photo, you can't really tell. What would you expect if it was an entrance wound? a contact entrance wound.
Right. Well, I can tell with this photograph that it is a contact entrance wound due to the severity of the injury. But what would have been nice is if the hair was shaved, I'd be looking for gunpowder residue. I'd be looking for burning on the skin itself, on the brain itself, and on the skull itself.
So when this goes, back up for just a second. The first shot, I believe you agree to the chest that your Dr. Reamer is correct.
I do.
This shot, which would be on the top right back, is, can you tell or would you have an opinion as to his posture at the time of that shot?
Well, it's sort of similar to what we were talking about with Maggie, unless somebody is in an elevated position where they're high enough where it can come down like this, he's most likely bent over.
Further than that, about that, I mean.
That's hard for me to say. Okay. I mean, his head's over like this because we have the smaller wound, the bigger wound as it's expanding out here, and the directionality goes like that. I can't tell you how far down he was actually bent over.
And why would he be bent over?
Well, the second you get this shot, you're immediately deceased.
No, I'm talking about before the shot.
Right, and so that, and we know that he fell forward, he has abrasions to his face, so that indicates to me that the belly shot was first.
When you say the belly shot?
The shot that comes across the chest, not the belly. And that would be extremely painful. So that would cause, you know, he may be bent over from the pain, and then came this shot.
Would that first shot affect his ability to breathe at all?
It would.
In what way?
Well, Dr. Reamer documented what's called pulmonary contusion, so bruising of the lung. And it's hard on a postmortem x-ray to see if you have what's called a pneumothorax, so air that's around the lung. So it'll be difficult for him to breathe.
Could you take that down, Doug, please? Okay, so you believe that he was in pain as he bent over and then somebody shot him in the top of the head?
Well, yes, this is a painful injury.
Okay. Now, let me ask you about just a couple more things.
Should I go back up?
Yes, please. Well, yeah, go back up. Can I have Defendant's Exhibit 189, please? Okay, tell us what this is, please.
So this is, I'm sorry.
Have you seen this before?
Yes, sir, I have.
And is it from the same book as the gunshot, the shotgun?
Yes, it's from the DeMeo gunshot wound book.
And what does it depict? I mean, I'm not telling you specifically what it depicts, but what does it depict?
What the appearance on the body would be at different ranges for shotgun wounds.
Okay. Offer this in evidence, Your Honor.
Your Honor, this Kate objects. This is hearsay. This is a book by a page from a book by somebody else, not the witness who's testifying.
Your Honor, she had not objected to two other, her witness and this witness, relating to the same book, different page. It's a learned treatise, and it's in the Bible of gunshot wounds for, I mean, both Dr. Reamer and this witness have testified. It's something they all rely on. I can have him sketch it out, or we can just put this in.
Says the state.
It's hearsay, Your Honor.
That's it. Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll have you go to the jury room for a break. Please do not discuss the case.
Thank you.
So, doctor, this page 189, what is it?
So this is a photocopy from a page of the gunshot wound book that gives a pictorial diagram of what different range of fires would look like on the skin of a shotgun wound victim.
Anything else from the state or the defense?
Your Honor, under 803 hearsay, the number 18, learned treatises, to the extent called to the attention of an expert witness upon cross-examination or relied by and directed statements contained in published treatises, periodicals, or pamphlets on a subject of history, medicine, or other science or art, establishes a reliable authority by the testimony admission of the witness or by other expert testimony or by judicial notice, if admitted, may be read into evidence, but may not be received as exhibits. I'm sorry. So I'll withdraw it as an exhibit, and I'll have him do a drawing.
All right. Okay, we'll take 15 minutes.
That wraps up the first segment of coverage in the trial of Alec Murdaugh. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage right here. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to take care of yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps. Ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.